Okay, Liz, here's some quick math. The less your business spends on operations, multiple systems, delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs, you cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and you improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors.
Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/Hollywood. netsuite.com/Hollywood. netsuite.com/Hollywood.
Okay, who's having a drink?
I think I'm doing a martini.
Oh, in honor too.
Of the martini scene.
Yes, the martini scene of our pilot. We should have martinis. Everybody in?
Yeah, definitely.
Hi, and welcome to Happier in Hollywood, the podcast about how to be happier, healthier, saner, more creative, more successful, and more productive in a backbiting, superficial, chaotic, unpredictable, fundamentally insane world. I'm Sarah Fain, a TV writer and producer living in LA, and with me is my high school friend and writing partner of 18 years, Liz.
That's me, Liz Craft. On this podcast, we talk about being writers in Hollywood, how we balance a career and friendship, and how to survive the war of attrition that is life in Los Angeles. And today, we are live at one of the fixed locations. We're near Paramount Studios in the heart of Hollywood. So there'll be some ambient sound that we don't have in the studio.
And today we're going to talk about post-production, which we are about to move into. What is it and why is it so hellish?
So many reasons.
Ugh.
And we'll get into them all. Then we're going to talk to one of our very favorite development executives, Juan Alfonso of ABC Studios. And we'll have a hair-related Hollywood hack that comes straight from the head of our hair department on The Fix.
All right, so Liz, first up is our segment From the Treadmill Desks Of, in which we discuss what's most pressing in our work psyches this week. And this week it's post-production. There's writing scripts, there's prepping and shooting scripts, and then there's post-production.
Yes, it's like you finish the last scene of the show and you think like, okay, now we're done. But no, you're just starting because you have to edit the thing.
Now, the post-production schedule on an episode of a show often is not that bad.
Right.
Depending on...
You might have months to finish something.
Exactly. On a pilot, it's hideous. You basically have a month from when you finish shooting to when you turn in the final cut to the network to edit, do music, do sound design, do visual effects, do ADR. What does ADR stand for?
Good question.
It's basically when the actors go into a sound studio.
Alternative dialogue recording?
Maybe.
That's my guess.
Actors go into a sound studio, and like if the sound was bad on set or on the location, they do it into a microphone where the sound is controlled, and then you put that kind of on top of the scene.
Sometimes if things are confusing, the studio or network might ask for ADR lines to clarify something. So then you have to put dialogue on someone's back. So if you're ever watching TV and you notice there's a lot of lines on someone's back, it's probably because it was added in post.
Exactly.
There's a saying that we all laugh about, which is fix it in post. Like if anything is going on wrong on set, someone's just like, we'll fix it in post, which is like post hates that, of course, because then all these problems are dumped in their lap.
Yes. Liz, we have late breaking news from Shara. ADR is additional dialogue replacement.
Okay. I wasn't so far off with my alternative dialogue recording.
Yes, so thank you, Shara.
Now, the thing about post, Sarah, that, you know, is added stress beyond just the time frame is just like we get notes throughout the script process and the pitch process, we get notes throughout the post process.
Yeah.
Once, you know, once the studio sees the first cut, they do testing.
Oh, God. Okay, so let's quickly go into kind of what happens after we finish shooting.
Okay.
And then we'll get to that part, which is the worst part.
I just jumped to the thing that makes my stomach churn and the bile rise in my throat.
Exactly. Okay, so we finish shooting. The director will then get like 4 days to do her cut.
Yes.
And then we come in and we only get 3 days to
insane.
Do our cut before it goes to the studio. And by the way, we get it on a Friday. We either get it late on a Thursday night or on a Friday morning. So 2 of our 3 days are weekend days,
yes.
Which is why my aunt is coming to town. Thank you, Aunt Jean. And then it goes to the studio. The studio will watch it, give notes, and then it's like an incredibly short period of time also before it goes to the network for the first time.
Yes, and then during this whole time, we're working with our composer, who our composer on The Fix is Greg Trippi, to get original music going. And so he's got an incredibly short amount of time.
Yes. Now, it used to be that you would just sort of put in temp music. You would pick a movie or a TV show that had the same kind of music philosophy as your show and put in temp music. And, you know, it may have worked, it may have not have worked, but the music bar was a bit lower. Now you have to have a composer compose your entire pilot before it goes for the final time to the network.
And if you're putting in what we call needle drops, which are the songs playing in the show, you have to know that you can clear them. In other words, that you can pay for them. So you can't just put in a Rolling Stones song because you like it. It may cost like hundreds of thousands of dollars. You need to know that all of the songs you're choosing fit into the budget that you have for the pilot, because the studio doesn't want the network to fall in love with a song that's too expensive.
Right. And sometimes post can be really fun. I mean, it's definitely a group, like an intensely group-oriented activity. You're basically sitting in a dark room with the other producers and the editor for days on end.
Yes, and sometimes executives come in for long stretches of time as well.
And it can be really fun. Like, we're talking about the hellishness of it, which is largely the time frame.
Yeah.
And really creative. Sean Ryan always talked about editing as the final rewrite.
Which it really is.
Yeah. And that part can be really fun. It can also just be super stressful because sometimes on a pilot, you don't get things. Like there are things in the script, and for a variety of reasons, the director didn't shoot them. This happened on a pilot that we had. And then you're trying to cut around an enormous
gap. Make something
gap.
Out of nothing.
Yes. And that can be absolutely hellish. I don't anticipate that on this pilot.
No, I think we've really got good coverage on everything.
Yeah.
Knock on wood.
Yeah. And in those times, you're literally just, I mean, you're in the editing room 24/7.
I'm reminded of a pilot we did, Sarah, where we watched the first cut, the director's cut, by ourselves in a dark room. Oh. And you were like, excuse me for a second. And you stepped out and made a call.
I called my parents and said, you need to come to town immediately. Can you be here tomorrow?
And this was, I have to add, after they'd already been helping you out a lot for an extended period of time and had just returned
home.
Yes,
exactly. I was like, you have to come back. And they did. They did come back. I've learned some lessons since then. I already have my aunt lined up to be
here.
You
know you need someone.
Yeah. And then, Liz, the eating.
Yes. As hard as it is not to eat a lot on set, all you have to do in editing is stress eat.
Yeah.
I mean, if ever there were a time when I am going to chow down on Porto's potato balls, it is in editing.
Yeah.
It's like eating gets you through the day.
Yeah. Snacking and leaving to eat and
and you're just sitting, I mean, butt in chair for like 15 hours.
Yeah. So I think we need to be preemptive and have some kind of plan in place. Like, we need to have an entire table full of cut up green apples sprinkled with cinnamon or something.
You know what we should do also is set a steps goal. Like, even if it's not 10,000, like, let's say we have to get 5,000 steps.
That's good. And we'll be in there with Marcia, and she's very good about like getting up and walking and, being active. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's our goal.
All right. So say we get through all that. Then we get to what I mentioned earlier, which is testing. Yeah. And testing is when it's first the studio and then the network, but the studio is sort of the level at which we really are deeply engaged with it. Show the pilot to an audience, a random audience, usually 50-50 male, female. And it's that thing where they're turning a dial. If they like it, they turn the dial up. If they don't like it, they turn the dial down. If they feel that they would just turn the channel, they click it off and you still see their reaction, but they're now, their little circle is turned into a triangle and you know that they're not watching your show.
The triangle is like the worst thing you can see.
And you watch it in usually live as they're doing this. So you're just sort of seeing it go up and down, pink for women, blue for men. You're seeing the triangles pop up. And it is the most nerve-wracking,
gutting
experience. And then afterwards, people are divided into groups and they're grilled about what they think about the show. And for whatever reason, the way they do testing, it's always very negative stance toward the show. So it's never like, what did you love? It's like, what confused you? What did the main character do that turned you off to them? You know, it's
what did you hate the most about this shitty pilot? That's what it feels
like. Exactly. It's awful. But anyway, based on testing, we then do another pass on the show. A lot of times it's confusion issues or somebody isn't popping enough. So maybe you give them more close-ups or you change music in the scene to communicate to the audience what they're supposed to be feeling.
Yeah. And then at some point you turn the whole thing over to the network and you just hope for the best.
And that's when we do a lot of hikes on Fryman Canyon.
Exactly.
While we wait.
Yes. To try to calm our nerves. And that, I mean, it's a couple weeks until you find out whether your show is going.
And during that time, we're meeting with writers.
Yeah.
Because what we're hoping is that we're going to have to staff this show. And as always, it's a feeding frenzy. So the second we get news, yes, this is going, we want to be able to make offers to several writers. So it's not even like we're totally relaxed.
No, it never lets up.
No.
And then if your show goes, it never lets up again.
As we say, it's the only business where you pray for hell.
Yep.
For the next 100 episodes of hell.
So that's post-production. Let's hope we're in post-production hell for many years to come.
Yes. Up next, we'll talk to ABC Studios development executive Juan Alfonso. But first, a word from our sponsor. There are some stories about my mom's life that I truly never get tired of hearing. For instance, her first job was as a movie usher, and she would walk around with a flashlight and tell people to get their feet off the seat, and I just love hearing about it. Well, just in time for Mother's Day, I found the perfect gift that captures all her stories for my family forever. It's called Storyworth. Storyworth helps you preserve precious memories and stories from your mother or your mom figure's life for years to come. And at the end, you get it all put together in a book. And I know I will be so happy to have that book on the shelf and be able to open it anytime I want and read a wonderful story about my mom.
Give all the moms in your life a unique, heartfelt gift you'll all cherish for years. Storyworth. Right now, you'll save $10 on your first purchase when you go to storyworth.com/Hollywood. That's storyworth.com/Hollywood to save $10 on your first purchase.
Sarah, now it's time for our favorite new segment, which we call Name That Hollywood Job. Because everyone knows about writers and directors and actors and publicists, but there are so many interesting and unusual, or at least unusual to people outside of Los Angeles, jobs. And we're going to talk about all of them.
Yes, and today we're going to talk to ABC Studios Vice President of Drama Development, Juan Alfonso, who has been working with us on The Fix. Since he came to ABC Studios in 2013, Juan has worked on a number of projects that became series, including the Emmy-winning American Crime from John Ridley and Secrets and Lies, starring Juliette Lewis and Ryan Phillippe. Am I saying Phillippe right?
You are.
Okay, good. Thank you. And Marvel's television series Agent Carter, and this season's Kevin Probably Saves the World. Previously, Juan led new content development and production for ESPN International, overseeing the launch of new documentaries, scripted programs, and selected audio shows in all five continents.
Yes, recently Juan's play, An Educated Guess, was read at Steppenwolf Theater in Chicago, which is huge.
So he is multi-talented.
Renaissance man.
Yes, exactly.
Juan, welcome,
thank
Juan.
You.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited. I'm as you guys know, I'm a fan of the show.
Yeah, you are in our Facebook group, which I appreciate.
I am. I think I'm pretty sure I'm the only guy in the whole group, but I love it.
There's a few.
Yes, you're an official friend of the pod.
I love it.
Yeah. Well, first of all, tell us what a development executive does, because I think most people have absolutely no idea.
Okay. Well, I think the reason why is because we do different things at different times.
Uh-huh.
And the way I try to explain it is, the first part of our job is to be a matchmaker, and it's a matchmaker of idea and people.
Mm.
So, you know, it's ideas that hopefully eventually can turn into TV shows with writers, with producers, with directors, with a whole host of people that can make it come to life. That's the first part of our job. And in broadcast television, that tends to be in the summer and into the fall. Then the second part of our job is really about, it's almost like a book editor. We give feedback, and we give feedback on every step of the process, whether it's on an outline of what the script is going to become, whether it's the script itself, whether it's the rough cuts, whether it's music,
going all the way back to pitches.
That's right. We start all the way at the pitch, right? And so the idea there is to sort of hold up a mirror to what it is that's presented to us and say, I think you meant to say this, but it's coming off as this. And I think you guys are doing great here. I think the network's going to react negatively to this. Why don't we think of it another way? That's sort of the feedback part of the job. And then the final part of the job, as I see it, is really to help the creators navigate through this very difficult system that is development, this very difficult process, which is, I think the reason it's so hard because it has so many steps and people get fatigued. So our job is to help navigate, to encourage, to cheerlead when necessary, to help avoid pitfalls and so on.
Yeah, and we should clarify, you work for the studio, so you're a seller,
right?
And the network is the buyer.
Right.
So you and we also, but I think you really need to see everything as a selling tool.
Yes,
and that does start with the pitch, and you are the first person who heard the fixed pitch. And awesome. I remember watching you smile during it and thinking, well, this is good.
Not even the pitch, like the kernel of the idea.
It was
you
like
were sitting in our office.
2 minutes. We were in Lori's office.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
And we were like, listen to this.
I've been accused of being very expressive during pitches, which is, I think, a good thing.
Yeah, well, it was good in that case because we could tell you liked it.
So how does someone become a development executive, and what are the different kind of levels leading up to where you are?
Sure. Well, my journey is very, very different, right? I worked in advertising for almost 10 years.
Uh-huh.
I did TV commercials and print ads and billboards and everything else. Then I worked in sports television for about 10 years. And I first started in marketing, but then I did documentaries and documentary series and studio shows, news, all sorts of different things. So I came into this as a 40-year-old guy from the side door. What usually happens is people start as assistants either at an agency or a network at a studio, and they work their way up to become a coordinator, and then they become a junior executive, creative executive, and they work their way up.
And what made you make the switch into being a development executive?
You know, my first switch was actually at ESPN when I was working in marketing, and I was working in the international business, and we had a very, very successful documentary series here at ESPN in the United States. And I went to my boss and I said, you know, I think we can do this sort of thing for the international space. And I made him a deal. I said, I'll do both jobs for a year. And if I'm good, you'll let me do the job. And if I'm terrible, I'll go back to just being a marketing guy. And amazingly, they said yes. And I don't know if I got lucky or if I've done something right in a previous life, but I got a lot. I got 3 shows on the air in the first year.
Oh, my God.
And it snowballed from there. So that's how that started. And then when I moved to – because that was in New York City. When I moved to Los Angeles – I was at this charity event. I was sitting next to a Disney ABC recruiter. She's like, "Oh, we need a development person at the studio." And I said, "Well, what I do is different. No, just come talk to us. So I went and I sat down with the guy who became my boss, Michael McDonald, who's an incredible producer and a friend.
Yeah.
And we hit it off, and he hired me.
You know what I want to know, Juan, from a selfish point of view, is writers. So obviously a huge part of your job is working with writers.
Yes.
What mistakes do we make over and over again that you feel you could stop us from making? Because I think a lot of times we don't, it's just a lack of knowledge. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like we need a school to tell us, like, this is how you work with development executives. I feel like we've learned over the years by making a lot of mistakes, whatever. But I would love for you to tell writers out there, what can they do right and what are they? Do you often see them do wrong in the process?
The biggest mistake that I see often is trying to guess what the network is going to want.
Well, we do that all the time.
and really writing to that versus writing to what you feel is right. And it's easy to do because they are the customer, right? And at least supposedly the customer is always right, which is not true. Sometimes we have to show them what's right. Or to what the studio is. You know, again, the iterative process that development is makes it's great for getting you to second guess yourself.
Yes.
And often people default to like, well, what do they want? And I would encourage people to when they recognize, when they're aware that they're thinking that way or that they're starting to act that way, to take a step back and say, wait, why did I start writing this? What was it that I fell in love about this? What was it that people got excited about? And to write to that. When you start to guess what the network's going to want, the result is almost always a little bit blander, a little bit more vanilla, a little bit more down the middle. So that's my first thing. My second thing, which, again, it comes with experience, and maybe you have to hit a few walls face first to do this, but it's to pick battles. You know, some people come in and they fight every single battle like it's Iwo Jima, and it's not good for your health. It's not good. You know, you're going to run out of energy. It's to really recognize the things that are worth fighting to... Because when you do, then they're really going to matter. And then people will most likely be like, you know what? These are reasonable folks. This is really important to them. All right, let's go ahead. Let's go ahead and try to make this happen. Mm-hmm. And then the final thing is sometimes people come in with a us versus them attitude or mindset.
Mm-hmm. We suffered from that early in our career.
Yeah.
We're familiar.
You know, and it's again, it's easy to go that way because you're very passionate about telling this story in a certain way. You think you're on the same page at the beginning of the process, and all of a sudden, you know, you're thrown all these roadblocks. And it's very, very easy to think like, wait, is it something against me? And I promise you the studio and the network also want this to be amazing. And the only way through that is through communication and dialogue and transparency and, you know, trying to put feelings aside and say, all right, let's talk this through. And more often than not, it gets resolved, at least in my experience.
And the notes process, because I think one of the hardest things for writers is dealing with getting notes. Mm-hmm. I think we've gotten so used to it in our career that it doesn't even faze us, really, because we don't take it personally.
Right.
But what's your advice for young writers who are just experiencing this gauntlet of notes for the first time? Because I mean, on our first pilot we ever did, when we got our first notes from the network, we wanted to quit. I mean, legitimately, not because we were being brats, but we were like, well, they don't like us. Obviously, we shouldn't be doing this project. This is insanity. And we didn't know that was fairly normal.
Yeah, it is. It is. And look, different places give more or less feedback. Different executives give more or less feedback. And the level of detail varies as well. But there is that, you know, the scenario where you're, you know, developing your first thing and you get just an overwhelming avalanche of stuff to where you don't even know where to start.
Right.
And what I would say is to, one, remember that it is fairly normal, So you're not the first or the last person to go through this. The second thing is to, you know, if it's well organized, that avalanche, it'll at least have, here's the four or five most important things. Mm. And I would do two things. I would think about those, even though they're probably the most daunting ones. Start immediately, see if you can tackle one or two. Because once you get momentum, I have found, and I've talked to a lot of sort of young writers on this, once you get momentum, then you're like, okay, well, this is not that bad. I've gotten one of these. And then another trick is, if there's a few easy ones, do those. And then sort of trick yourself like, okay, I kind of got this going. I'm good. Okay, I can tackle some of the bigger ones.
Yes.
That's great advice.
It is. So we talked about how you were our first stop for the pitch of the fix. When writers come to you with an idea, when they come to you with a pitch, what are you looking for?
So the biggest thing that I look for is just some good old fashioned storytelling. I want to be leaning in. I want to hear, I want to have a visceral reaction. I want to like be dying to know what's next. You know, if you make me feel something in that pitch, I'm much, much more likely to buy it. And then there's some more operational things. It needs to be sustainable. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of ideas that are great but aren't big enough to sustain a television show. I personally look for originality. You know, if we're going to do a police procedural, okay, well, what's interesting and different about it? You know, that's the one thing that I learned in my marketing years is one of the big important points of selling a product is differentiation, you know? And how do you, one of my clients was Miller Lite. It doesn't get more down the middle, right? And then there was Bud Light and Amstel Light and God knows whatever. You know, how do we make this different? What is it that we say about this product that makes it different? Similarly, when you pitch a story, it's like, well, it does have all these things that people love about two-hander cop procedural, but this is what's going to give it that top spin. This is why people watching the promo are going to like cock their heads and say, all right, well, that's cool. I'm interested. I'm going to talk to my friend about it or my wife about it, and we're going to check this out. So that's really important. And then, you know, this is related to the first part, which is passion. Mm. And you can't fake it. People either come in and they're really passionate and you can immediately tell from your gut or they're not. And that's not to say that we don't buy all sorts of things, but when people come in with passion for a certain subject matter or a theme or a character, again, we're much more likely to buy it.
Now, Juan, before we let you go, do you have any Hollywood hacks, like suggestions for how we can stay happier in this crazy, crazy business?
I do. So, one of my New Year's resolutions was to drop a few lbs on nothing other than, I guess, health, but vanity more than anything. I looked in the mirror and I'm like, we could do better. So one thing I think that, which is your New Year's resolution, to weigh yourself.
Yeah,
I've done that for years. I think that's fantastic. And but you do have to write it down.
Yes, and I'm doing that.
Yeah, it's very important. And I actually use an app called MyFitnessPal, where it gives you a little graph chart, and if you see it going down, that builds momentum. You're like, oh, look at this, a little downward trend, and then you that day you're more motivated to eat better. But the one thing that I've tried, which I had heard about for a while, is this thing called intermittent fasting, where you only eat for 8 to 9 hours in the day. So, for example, if you have your first meal at noon, you can eat up to 8 o'clock at night, and then you have to fast the rest of the time. There's physical, biological reasons that I don't quite understand why it's good for you. It's supposed to help you live longer. It has all these health benefits. But to me, just by the fact that I skip breakfast, which was hard at first, but I've gotten used to it now, that in combination with my little calorie count thing, it has had great results. And you have to eat the same amount of calories. It's not like you eat less. You just have to eat it in a compressed period of time.
Okay.
Right? And I've dropped almost 20 pounds since the beginning of the year.
Wow. So, well, you really yeah. look great.
Thank you.
Very
thank
handsome
you.
Man.
Wow. Stop it. thank you. But I actually keep going. the reality is, for me, once I start to see results, and you can see results pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. And again, that motivates me to keep going. And I reached my goal, which was to reach 180 pounds. And now I have to go into my next phase. Like, okay, I don't want to lose anymore. How do I maintain this
right.
thing? But intermittent fasting, you know, over 3 months, my goal is to lose a pound a week, something like that. And it's worked pretty well. I think people should check it out.
Well, Juan, we, first of all, thank you for supporting The Fix as you have from day one. You've been an amazing cheerleader and partner, and hopefully you will continue to be so for several years. Well, yeah. What we should say, the yeah. weird thing is when you're a development executive, though, you take it the project through like the first six episodes
yeah.
and then you're on to new development and you get we get handed over to current. So
yeah.
hopefully next year we'll be here with our current executive talking
exactly.
to them.
Yes.
Yes.
And with new development.
Yeah. Yes. Well, we'll see about that.
Yes. Thank you so much.
Thank
Juan.
You guys.
Thanks,
really appreciate
Juan.
It.
I don't know about you, but we're always looking for ways to get our kids involved and give back in our local community. That's why we're excited to tell you about Student Visionaries of the Year, a campaign by the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, which is the largest nonprofit organization dedicated to creating a world without blood cancers. Student Visionaries of the Year is a 7-week philanthropic leadership development program for high school students. Participants form strong teams and fundraise in honor of a pediatric blood cancer survivor in their local community. I would love for Violet to do this program when she's in high school.
This program is transformative. It not only helps students develop valuable life skills like project management, communication, financial literacy, and entrepreneurship, not to mention it looks great on college applications, but most importantly, it's also a chance for them to engage in meaningful work within their community and make a real impact on blood cancer patients and their families. You can learn more about Student Visionaries of the Year or even nominate a student at lls.org/students. That's lls.org/students. Okay, Sarah, it's time for this week's Hollywood Hack. Hair tips from The Fix's amazing hair department, Doug Kirkpatrick and Mio Lai. So, Sarah, we all want better hair.
Yes, we do.
Safe to say, but there are so many products and we don't know what they all do and which ones are the best. So we figured we have experts amongst us. Let's ask them to suggest some products.
Yeah, a couple products that not everyone would know about, but that could improve our hair game and make us look glamorous and Hollywood-y.
Especially when we don't have time to shower.
Exactly,
which
yeah.
I've discussed on this podcast. I've done less and less of as the pilot has progressed.
Exactly. Yeah, so Doug and Mio gave us a couple hair products that they use on actors and actresses' hair, and we are going to share them with you. The first one is Osis powder. Liz, these things are so sort of inside baseball that we don't even totally understand what they do.
Yes.
So tell us what Mio said about Osis powder.
Well, this is a powder that you use when you've been sweating a lot, which can happen on a set. So the powder, you put it on your scalp and it clings to new hair growth, which is hair that is fresh, virgin hair that hasn't been touched. And it clings to that and I think sort of separates the little new hairs and causes volume. And this is something that's great to use if you've been sweating, like I said. And he said they use it all the time in Dancing with the Stars because that show, all the contestants sweat so much, they need to have their hair touched up. So they'll put Osis powder on to refresh their volume.
And keep it glamorous.
Yes, keep it glamorous and not lank, sweaty, dangling locks of hair.
Okay, so that's a good one. And then we also have Doug's recommendation, which is Oribe Dry Texture Spray. So that you also spray on new growth, and it's sort of like a dry shampoo. It texturizes and makes your hair appear fresh and voluminous.
Yes, and I love the fact that these are all like sort of in place of a dry shampoo
mm-hmm.
because it seems like an easy way to look professional and put together. Like for those of us who aren't actors on sets, having someone do our hair, this is a way to just look better.
And everyone needs volume. I mean, yes. Every day I struggle with how to make my hair less flat. So I'm going to go out and get some Oribe dry texture spray.
Yes. And one interesting thing to note, Sarah, we asked Doug and Mia, well, how are these different from just using hairspray? Like, right. What's the difference in these products?
Yeah.
One thing is hairspray is on the surface of the hair. These are products that you use at the scalp level. So we wish everyone luck with their new hair products. Let us know if they work for you. I want to hear. And Sarah, you and I can check back in and see if we've upped our hair game.
Yes.
Thank you. So thank you, Doug and Mio, for those tips.
And that is it for this episode of Happier in Hollywood. Email us or send us a voice memo at happierinhollywood@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, and please subscribe if you haven't already.
Thanks to Shara Morris for helping out on this episode. Thanks to our producer, Jennifer Lai. Also, thanks to Kristen Meinzer and Andy Bowers of Panoply. Thank you to Gretchen Rubin. Happier in Hollywood is part of the Onward Project.
Get in touch. I'm on Instagram at sfain, and Liz is at lizcraft. We also have a Facebook group. Search for Happier in Hollywood on Facebook to join in on the conversation.
You can also follow The Fix on Twitter, Sarah.
Yes.
At The Fix Writers. Until next week, I'm Liz Craft.
And I'm Sarah Fain. Thanks for joining us. It's a fun job.
And we enjoy it.
Liz, you can see the Hollywood sign from here.
Oh, my gosh.
Isn't that crazy?
Remember, we could see it from the window of our very first office on a primetime show?
I remember that. Yes, that was not a fun job.
We did not enjoy it.